Welcome to Coffee with Kupke, a production of St. Paul Inside the Walls. Here on Coffee with Kupke, we grab a cup of coffee, at least we're claiming this is coffee. We sit with Monsignor Kupke, Raymond Kupke, the pastor of St. Anthony's in Hawthorne, professor at Immaculate Conception Seminary, diocesan archivist. We sit with Monsignor Kupke to delve into the history of Catholicism in the Diocese of Paterson. My name is Father Paul Manning. I am the vicar for evangelization for the Diocese of Paterson. And here I am with Monsignor Kupke. So grab your cup of coffee and let's jump right in. I'm going to take a sip. So we left the Benedictines at the foundation of St. Paul's Abbey in Newton. One of the other communities that comes upon the diocesan scene, Newark, eventually to be Paterson, are the Trinitarians. So you talk about the Trinitarian women coming on the scene. And I particularly wanted to talk about this because your great friend Father Judge,
yes,
is associated with this. So
the Trinitarians are an unusual religious community because they are a family of three different branches. And unlike most religious orders, the lay branch is the oldest.
Mm.
And, you know, this is Father Judge, Father Thomas Judge.
Yes.
The great apostle of the laity in the early 20th century, trying to rev up a core of lay evangelists. You know, he
sounds
referred to the lady
very contemporary,
the sleeping giant of the
yes,
church.
Yeah. You know? And he had a sense that every lay person had an apostolate.
An apostolate. Yeah. And even more, and he practiced this in a couple of places in New Jersey, there were places that the clergy could not get to, not only physically, but where they would not be welcome, that lay evangelists could get into and make some headway. So the sisters, the Trinitarian sisters, evolve out of that. You know, some of these lay associates living in community. And then later on, the priests, the Trinitarian fathers.
So he purchased property for the lay apostolate.
Some of them have purchased it.
Oh, okay.
The property at Sterling, particularly the corner property there, predates both of the orders. They've had that. There was a place.
I believe it's called Trinity House now.
Yes. Yeah. It's all of his places were Trinity.
Yeah.
Trinity Heights, Trinity Hill, Trinity Swamp, Trinity. You know, he named everything after the Trinity. But he was an interesting character. But basically, they got that in – they call it Gillette, actually.
Yes.
As a rest and recuperation spot for their lay members to go over the weekend to recuperate from the rigors of working downtown in the cities.
And eventually, the property becomes the St. Joseph's Shrine
right.
with sisters and
right. and. We know that Judge himself, it's interesting to see the interaction of, you know, these lay groups. The Knights of Columbus get revved up in this period in New Jersey.
Okay.
And they have a, now we're talking about the 20s now, they have a bent toward doing youth work.
Mm.
So they organize the Columbus Cadets of New Jersey. This is the earliest KFC youth.
Yeah.
And basically they hire a full-time man to coordinate this.
Yes.
And they are running retreats for boys at Sterling. And very often it was Father Judge that they would bring in to do these retreats.
Wow.
And ultimately, the Knights of Columbus, you may remember this, but you're a little bit younger than me, organize a summer camp up in Branchville, Camp Columbus,
okay,
on Culver's Lake.
Yes. Okay.
So all of this is taking place, you know.
And I'll make an aside here and let folks know that Monsignor Kupke's doctoral dissertation was on a layman associated with Father Judge, who actually almost became a member of the community.
But who first met Judge at Sterling.
Interesting. James Norris, who was one of the few, if not the only, lay...
He was the only layman to participate in the debates of Vatican II. I think there were three people that gave speeches, but Norris actually introduced the debate on a section of Gaudium et Spes.
Yes, because he was very involved in
right.
migrant populations right. after World
well,
War II.
The issue of the church getting organized on the international level to assist the poor. So out of that element comes of what later will be the Pontifical Council, Justice and Peace, and the Pontifical Council Quorum. You know, up to that point, there was no coordinating effort on the international level. All the church aid agencies were national.
Okay. And now it became international.
Caritas and Miserior and Catholic Relief Services. But Norris is pushing for the church to coordinate them on the international level.
Yes. And well, so I feel like I know Father James Norris, Mr.
Yes,
Norris.
You know him
well because Raymond was writing the book right. while we lived together writing the dissertation while we lived together at St. Peter's. So interesting detail that I found out. There's a connection between Darlington, the Newark Seminary, and Del Barton. Bishop, was it O'Connor at this point?
This is O'Connor.
Yeah. O'Connor and the Benedictines were looking at the same piece of property.
Yes.
But the bishop won. He got Darlington. And the Benedictines
bought, you know, the
Del Barton
yeah. mansion. Yeah.
And are these names the family names associated with those places?
Del Barton, as I understand it, is a conglomerate of the names of the three sons of the man who actually owned the property.
Okay. And Darlington, a family?
Darlington is the name of the neighborhood.
The area? Okay.
Yeah, the area. Yeah. In Mahwah Township.
So
if we actually owned all the property that these early bishops looked at, you know, we would be
land
property
barons.
Rich. And, you know, we would own William Patterson University.
Oh.
We looked at that property, okay. too.
Interesting. These are those in the footnotes of places we didn't buy?
I'd have to reread the footnotes.
Yeah. Okay, so the Jesuits buy an estate that becomes Loyola House
Loyola
of Retreats.
House of Retreats, right.
And apparently that sits on Mount St. Catherine. I didn't know that.
Yes.
Right? So
Catherine was the name of the lady that donated the property. So
do they still refer to it as Mount St. Catherine?
I don't believe so,
okay.
no.
Okay.
That's something like Our Lady of the Shrine of Our Lady of the Highway in Little Falls.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's still there, but nobody talks
nobody knows
about it.
About it. Yeah. It's in the Living Stones.
Yeah.
There was an interesting paragraph here on a religious community. I think started by Mother Clara, and Mother Clara gets expelled.
Yes.
So just a word about her. Maybe she's weird New Jersey, a weird diocese, but anyway.
This is it's an interesting because this group has just recently been disbanded.
Oh.
This is the Franciscan Sisters of Ringwood.
Okay, so what happened here? Well with Mother Clara first.
Mother Clara was kind of, she was a little bit like the sister in Alabama there. You know, she was a...
Mother Angelica.
Mother Angelica,
yeah.
She was a mover and a shaker, you know, but also difficult to deal with, you know, very independent. So
yes.
She moved her operation several times to West Virginia and Ohio, and ultimately wound up in Ringwood, New Jersey. And for a long time... we had to deal with her because it was the only religious community of diocesan rite as opposed to pontifical rite. So all of the nuns in the Patterson Diocese belong to an order that reports directly to Rome, except for these this little group. They reported directly to the Bishop of Patterson.
Okay.
And he had full responsibility. So there are some interesting details. She was not too good on canon law. So at one point we discovered that none of the nuns had made a canonical novitiate. And they had to come in and spend half a year like asking each nun, even the 60 and 70-year-old, you know, do you want to be a nun?
After they've done it for 30 years.
Exactly, so that we can post-date your novitiate, you know.
Yes, wow, interesting.
Yeah.
Well, so it looks like Mother Clara ran into trouble in Newark, and she got expelled, and then five of the sisters stayed intact in their own community, and then she had this...
One of my funniest moments as an archivist was dealing with their archivist as they were coming up, I think, for a 75th anniversary or a 50th anniversary as a community. And this poor younger sister was tasked with writing the history of the community, but none of the older nuns would talk about it because it was so messy with her being expelled. So she said to me, she said, it looks like we just dropped down out of the sky one day, fully formed.
Well, the paragraph has the expulsion of Mother Clara and the community survives without her.
Yeah.
And she bounces around with just maybe one other sister, but eventually
they
reconciles.
Take her back.
And comes back and dies.
Dies in
Ringwood.
Interesting.
It could
be the title of a movie.
Well, I was thinking.
She died in Ringwood.
So then we have the Baptistines, the Sisters of St. John the Baptist.
Yes. Who again, are barely in the diocese by a matter of feet. I think their property, I've had some interesting discussions with our diocesan attorney about whether they're ours or not, because their property, the bottom of their driveway is in the Metuchen Diocese.
Yes.
But by the time you get up to the buildings, that's our diocese.
Yeah, so they probably no longer own those, do they?
They still do.
Oh, okay.
They have not sold it yet. They have tried, but I don't think they've actually.
So I don't know if I mentioned this in an earlier episode, but I had a summer job at Mount St. John's.
Mount St. John's.
When I was in the seminary, or between college and seminary, and I weed whacked around a statue of St. John the Baptist at Mount St. John's, which was later given by the Sisters of St. John the Baptist to St. Paul Inside the Walls.
And it's outside.
John the Baptist is the patron of our diocese. I found out that Monsignor Silva had been donated that statue. I couldn't believe it because I weed whacked around it, and here I am.
Little did you know when you're weed whacking that you and the statue would have a future together.
Yeah, we don't have any grass around it, so I don't have to weed whack anymore.
That property is always referred to as Mount St. John's and Gladstone.
Yes,
and of course Gladstone is in Somerset County.
Oh,
With the postal address, but the property is actually in Mendham Township.
Yeah. Then we have the Carmelites. So the Carmelites come to Morristown and create a cloistered convent there.
Which they opened a Christmas week.
Yes.
Their founding.
That's one of the Christmas episode mentions.
There's a West Virginia connection there because the founders at one point, I think, did their novitiate at the Carmel in Wheeling.
Hello, this is Bishop Kevin Sweeney of the Diocese of Patterson, and I have a new podcast called Beyond the Beacon. One of the things I love about this podcast is that I get to interview Catholics of different ages and backgrounds and learn what inspires them to live a life of faith, hope, and love. Join me on Thursdays for Beyond the Beacon, wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or watch it on my YouTube channel. Click the link in the description to learn more. Thank you, and God bless you.
Yeah, and Raymond, maybe part of Weird Diocese is the later story of the Carmelite monastery in the 1980s. Will we get to that?
We don't talk about that yet.
Okay, not yet. We have the Sisters of Christian Charity. who come.
You and I are both very familiar with them.
Yes, they worked for many years, work still at Morris Catholic.
Right. Yeah. And they come much like the Franciscan friars because of
the Kulturkampf.
Kulturkampf in Germany. Yeah. And they come originally to, I think, Hazleton, Pennsylvania.
And then move east.
But then eventually they establish an Eastern mother house in the 1930s in Mendham.
Yeah. Yeah. The Sisters of the Good Shepherd, who used to have a place right outside of Morristown on Kadena Road.
Right, which is now the Hebrew Seminary, I think.
Okay.
The Rabbinical College.
Okay. So are the Sisters of the Good Shepherd still around?
Or? No, at least not in our diocese.
Okay.
They were popular in the 19th century because they worked with what was, you know, a term that would be no longer politically correct at all, wayward girls.
Okay, yeah.
So girls in trouble, girls who were on the street, they would be assigned sometimes by the courts and they would be cared for and tried to be rehabilitated. So they had a house in Morristown.
Yeah, and that was another mansion.
Another mansion, right?
Exactly. I attended priest support groups there early on.
And many of the early marriage encounter were there. A lot of stuff went on there. Yeah. That's also where basically what we're doing right now, the original diocesan communications office was in their carriage house.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
And it's also where the earliest of the permanent deacons were trained. That took place on their property.
Yes, I do remember that. And then
they were a very interesting group because they had a cloistered and a active group. And the cloistered group were the girls that ultimately decided to stay and join the convent, the wayward girls.
Wow.
And they became cloistered and made hosts and prayed for the active.
Interesting. They became the opposite of wayward. I wonder what's that word, the opposite of wayward?
Holy.
Oh, good. I like it.
But, you know, it's a concept that I don't know what they're doing today, but I can't imagine that concept
works
is
anymore.
Working anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. The
now, you know, if you're wayward, you have a solemn high funeral mass in St. Patrick's Cathedral.
Okay. That's a very timely comment.
Which should probably be excised.
Yeah. No, Joe doesn't do any editing like that. So the last group that I want to mention is the Filipinis who come at the invitation of Bishop Walsh.
Yes.
And he gives them a piece of property where they are to this day, correct?
Right.
And that was another
Villa Walsh
estate. And interestingly, it was named something else, but when Bishop Walsh died, because he was their great
protector,
patron,
founder,
they renamed it Villa Walsh.
Yes.
And so a lot of people probably wonder why it's named Villa Walsh.
Yeah, they have interesting stories about Walsh's relationship with the Filipinos. Yeah. Mm. He would. He was so promotional of them that he would give them stuff they couldn't handle.
Oh.
You know, like he was giving them brand new parish schools in Bergen County when they didn't have enough membership to staff all these places. You know, they were throwing, if you had 1 year of college, you were becoming a teacher and then you would get your degree on, you know,
on the fly.
Summers and,
yeah.
But one funny story I heard out of conversation was that the charities were coming up, I think, for their 75th anniversary, a solemn high mass and everything. And Walsh suggested to the charities that they invite the Filipinos to sing it, to sing the mass, because they had such a beautiful choir. And, of course, that did not sit well with them. So they had
what year was that?
This would be probably, in the 30s. Walsh is dead by 52.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. Wow. Well, the Filipinos have another great Episcopal friend, right? They're very close to Bishop Tsereteli as well.
They taught him.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, they taught him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're going to have to find a little hill.
They have hills on their property.
Yeah. Name it.
Mount Tsereteli?
Yeah. Yeah. Something.
Okay. The only ones you've forgotten are the Paulus up in Oak Ridge.
Oh, yes. Yeah, and they're important to mention because they were founded by Isaac Hecker, is
Isaac
that right?
Hecker, an American founded group, and they ultimately opened a novitiate up in Jefferson Township there. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know if we named all 15, but there were 15 communities.
15 communities that came into the
in
diocese.
In 15 years, yeah. One last little detail.
We will hear from the three that we didn't mention, I'm sure.
Yeah. They'll be in the comments section.
Right.
Yeah. I wanted to mention that during this era, and this is the last thing we'll talk about in this episode, is that the age for First Communion changed as a result of a directive named Quam Singulari, Quam Singulari in 1910.
Right.
Tell us what that was. And Quam Singulari means how unique, how
wonderful.
Yeah.
So we're talking about Pope Pius X, or St. Pius X.
The Pope of the Eucharist.
Pope of the Eucharist. And, his motto on becoming Pope was to restore all things in Christ. So in particular, this is a time when they're becoming very concerned. Interestingly, just like today, but in the opposite direction, they're becoming concerned about the Eucharist and that it is slipping away from its centrality in the life of the church.
Okay.
That many people are not receiving communion at all. This is when every year on the first Sunday of Lent, pastors will get up in the pulpit and remind everybody that
the
they had to receive communion at least once a year between now and Pentecost Sunday.
Yes.
And this was the time to go to confession and receive, because many people only received once a year.
Wow.
And also with the fasting involved.
Yeah, it was.
The later the Mass was, the less likely anybody was going to communion. So it was a whole different, it would be
true.
Unrecognizable by today's standards.
And the culture, I even think of my parents, the culture was to go to early Mass because you had fasted from the night before.
From midnight the night before.
And I think there's a detail in here that says at one point Masses afternoon were prohibited.
Right. You couldn't start Mass later than 11 o'clock, really. It had to end by noon.
Interesting.
So the whole Sunday operation. First of all, no Saturday night Mass. That didn't exist.
Right.
But the whole Sunday operation very often was started early.
Yes.
The pastor, we're talking about a little bit later now in the 40s, but the pastor of Mount Carmel in Bhutan, Monsignor Edward MacDonald, was very proud of the fact that he had the earliest Mass in the diocese on Sunday morning.
What time?
At 5:50.
Oh, Lord. Even God, is God awake at that hour?
Well, his whole thing was that the Eucharist, was elevated over Bhutan before anywhere else in the diocese.
Yeah.
This was the spirituality of the time.
Yeah.
But, if you, the notion of getting married at a nuptial Mass, it couldn't take place on Sunday because you couldn't have Mass after.
Got it.
So if you had a nuptial Mass on Sunday, it meant getting married at one of the parish Masses in the morning.
Interesting. We're going to have to leave it there. And the next time we pick up, we're going to return to First Communion. And then, believe it or not, in the next episode on Chapter 6, we're going to finish Chapter 6. So we will see you next time. Let's leave it there. I want all of you who are listening or watching to make sure that you keep an eye out or an ear out for the next episode of Coffee with Kupke. In order to stay on top of new releases, make sure you follow or subscribe wherever you're listening. And if you are on YouTube, please do drop a like and hit the bell for notifications. While you're at it, make sure to check out the other shows produced by the diocese. Those shows are Beyond the Beacon, hosted by Bishop Kevin Sweeney and Jay Agnish, our Director of Communications, and the Paul Street Journal, hosted by Brian Hansberger and Freddie Garcia. I want to give a special thanks to Joe Genexi, our sound and visual engineer, Caitlin Ferrari, who's involved in pre- and post-production, and Freddie Garcia, who's helping out with this podcast in addition to doing his own. With all that said, I just want to thank you for joining us in Coffee with Kupke. Keep making Catholic history in the Diocese of Patterson.